Hey Pod, we're back.
Oh yes, welcome to episode 4 of His Story Time. Story Time with a Historical Precedent. I'm Blake Anderson at Blander Anderson on Twitter, the more bland Anderson. This is the longest plug ever. I'm so sorry, Catherine, speak.
My name's Catherine Escalante at Catherine _461 on Twitter. Blake, do we have another Twitter to plug?
Oh my God, we do! It is the @history_timepod, and it is the Twitter of this podcast. So
we have a Twitter podcast.
If you got beef with us, you now have a handle to direct your anger towards. Woo!
Yeah. I can't wait.
We're being really cheerful now because this episode is also, fun fact, the worst.
Oh, yeah. If your heart isn't ripped in the middle, then I don't know.
just being blunt, like, we talk about racism, and Catherine and I both low-key panicked because we have some sound bites where we're like,
it's just silent.
Like, they're just silent, or we're just like, oh, that's cringy. Or we're thinking, like, in 20 years when we're running for the highest elected official in the United, like, as the highest elected official in the United States, that, like, there's going to be a counter campaign of, like, this thing we said 20 years ago, taken out of context where we, like, condemn racism, but it's sarcastic, and that's a thing to be worried about.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. I think we were both very caught off guard by the impression this episode would have on us personally, because as much as, like, we're sarcastic little fucks, and we talk about, like, history in a very, like, irreverent Gen Z kind of way, when we talk about stuff like racism and its prevalence in American history, it's very tough.
Yeah.
And I think we really forget about that.
Because, like, we started this episode, like, all wide-eyed, and we were like, yeah, we're gonna, like, condemn racism. Like, we're gonna, like, kick racism's ass. And then cut to the end, we're just, like, so bummed at the absolute institutionalized behemoth that is racism in United States history.
Totally.
So, wow. We're already getting depressing. We need to talk about happy things. Catherine, do you have any things you want to shamelessly plug right now?
Okay, yes. So, I've been Netflix binging, like, the fiend I am. Mm-hmm. I know. And I finished 2 shows. I've literally, wow. The first one is called Outer Banks.
And, which I still have to watch.
Oh my God, it's so good. So good. It's literally, it's amazing. It makes me want to live, like, by a seashore and just fish and boat and swim all day long.
And look for treasure.
And look for treasure. And I just, wow, it's amazing. And it's also, it has a twinge of psychological thriller.
Oh my gosh.
To the point where, like, I was screaming at my computer screen at 2 in the morning 2 nights ago, so loud that my mom came in and checked on me. And I was like, I'm so sorry. This show is currently breaking my mind. So, that's something. And then the other show is called Never Have I Ever.
Which, and you were plugging this to me before we started recording, so it must be amazing.
It is. It's produced by Mindy Kaling. She wants to, like, have more representation and diversity in television. And let me just tell you, this is the first, like, show where I've seen, like, a brown girl. like a brown girl, like, play the main character. And I was like, oh my gosh. And then when I started watching it, it was, like, the funniest thing ever. Like, it's so, so funny. And I was like, wow, this is awesome. So watch those 2 shows.
And your final plug of the podcast?
Oh my gosh, yes.
It's kind of new, kind of niche. I don't know if you've heard about it.
Yeah, it's this little novel called Crime and Punishment. It's very new. Not at all. Oh my gosh. So I've been trying to read more during this quarantine. So I ordered, like, a ton of books online, and I started Crime and Punishment first. And it's basically, like, this Russian crime novel in the perspective of a serial killer. And let me just tell you, I'm on page, like, 50 right now, and my heart is invested, and I love it. Wow. So
okay, time,
those are my plugs.
Time for my shameless plug. I am absolutely flabbergasted with this show on Hulu called Miss America. or Mrs. America, excuse me. That's a big deal in the show. It's got Kate Blanchett, Rose Byrne, and it's the equal it's the story dramatized of the Equal Rights Amendment. Phyllis Schlafly and her brigade of mothers versus the like the women's right and rights and liberation movement. And like this fucking show, dude. Like, jeez. Kate Blanchett is about to win all these awards for portraying this, like, very conservative, like, devout mother of six children who's trying to stop the Equal Rights Amendment. And, like, she's, like, she just does it in a way where you're, like, you love how, like, deliciously kind of evil and sly she is. But at the same time, like, you're questioning your own morality. And
that's so interesting.
And it calls out, like, problems. Like, it's a weirdly nonpartisan show. It calls out everyone's problems. Oh. And like politically, it's so good. If you have not given it a chance, do it will hook you in. Other than that, Catherine, did you have a quote for this? Hold up, I'm gonna get it. You stall, I'm gonna get it.
Okay, stalling starting now. Okay, I'm just going to go off what you were talking about with Mrs. America, right? Yeah. Right? Okay. I mean, I've heard of Phyllis before. She was Phyllis on an Albert question a really long time ago, and I remember her and looking her up. And I find her very interesting. I remember reading something on PragerU because I try and, like, consume a lot of conservative media along with, like, more liberal and centrist media to get a holistic picture of, like, whatever the fuck is going on in the world. And they had a very interesting post about her. So I'm excited to watch a show, learn more about her, and refer back to the post and figure out if it's bullshit or not.
It's so good. That's there's like a thing before each episode that's like, this is dramatized. And you're like, okay.
okay.
But on that note, this is Catherine's quote. I'll just be reading it. Oh, yes. This is my dramatic recitation. Get excited. It's by Kitty O'Meara.
It'll be better than mine.
Kitty O'Meara. And it is, and the people stayed home and read books and listened and rested and exercised and made art and played games and learned new ways of being and were still and listened more deeply. Some meditated, some prayed, some danced. Some met their shadows and the people began to think differently and the people healed. And in the absence of people living in ignorant, dangerous, mindless, and heartless ways, the earth began to heal. And when the danger passed and the people joined together again, they grieved their losses and made new choices and dreamed new images and created new ways to live and heal the earth fully as they had been healed. Kitty O'Meara. So that's a beautiful quote. Catherine picked it out and then we low-key forgot, yes. But it's great.
Yep, that's fine.
It's all fun.
I think it's fine for this episode because we talk about it. It kind of feels like it's not fitting, but I feel like we're all to the point in quarantine where we're just like, oh my God, I want to leave my house.
A connection for me too for this is like, so we're going to talk about like the way people are treated and things and like large scale problems. And like the funny thing about large scale solutions to those problems is that they grow. They're never just like something that just happens usually. They're gradual changes, just like the gradual changes we see here. Sometimes it takes a bigger problem for us to come together and find that bigger solution.
Yeah, so, that was beautiful.
Thank you. And on that note, we are going to leave you. So if you're going to be clearly bothered, we suggest you grab some snacks and you get comfortable as you listen to this episode of History Time.
Okay.
Everyone, buckle up. If you hate racists, I mean, stick around, but get ready to be angry. Just blatant racism here.
I'm ready.
No, today we're going to be talking about a little group of people called the Little Rock Nine. Catherine, are you familiar with the Little Rock Nine?
I'm not familiar with the story itself. I'm familiar with the context around it because, again, legal nerd. Brown v. Board.
This is absolutely amazing. And by amazing, I mean terrible. But at the same time, I'm going to tell you right now, it has a happy ending.
Yay.
It has a happy ending.
So after...
For the most part. For the most part. Like, yeah. so after, like, you know, centuries of racism, America kind of gets its shit together. I'm going to be swearing like a sailor in this section, but it's only because I'm passionate about being anti-racist. And sometimes...
We all should be.
Sometimes you can't adequately, like, describe the fervent emotions you have against racism, especially when they're propagated by the special interest groups they are in this story. So on that note, we're gonna give you a little bit of context here.
Blake,
first off,
see right now, by the way, I'm like, wow,
we're on FaceTime as this happens, and she can like see me just getting heated. And yeah. Before we talk about any Little Rock Nine, we have to talk about this little bitty called Plessy V. Ferguson, that slimy little skank. Plessy V. Ferguson was a Supreme Court case from 1896, mm-hmm. and it includes Catherine and I's favorite constitutional amendment. Catherine, tell them what they've won. The 14th
Amendment. We love it. Love to see it.
It calls into question the Equal Protection Clause, the separate but equal doctrine. We love to see it. That's literal. We do love to see it.
Yeah. We don't love to see the decision that Plessy v. Ferguson had.
No.
But
but yeah. So Plessy v. Ferguson called into question the role of education when it came to Reconstruction amendments and civil rights, as well as the access to education for African Americans and other minorities, as well as the majority white population. So with that, a lot of white people didn't want to engage in their education with minority members because for no reason other than racism. And because of this, Plessy v. Ferguson is taken to the Supreme Court of the United States. Because that's where we have to decide that white kids are too good for minorities in the 1890s. This is absolutely the worst. I freaking hate it! So, while we're here, I'm also just going to advocate that throughout history, there's this continuity that, like, education is more about making a person than it is making a living. And
yeah.
Society, when they can control education, sometimes they use it as a form of oppression. And sometimes directly, sometimes indirectly. The example that I like to think of is like the civil service exam in Han Dynasty China. Like, whereas any man could take the civil service exam, it became a thing for wealthier families wanting to buy into the bureaucracy to have like the most elaborate schooling possible, because they could afford it. So then they could essentially just buy the education to get into government.
Right.
And when you're poor, you obviously can't afford such an education. And that's an argument that we're still seeing today. However, in the case, back to Plessy v. Ferguson, the court rules that the separate but equal doctrine is upheld in the current means of education. So therefore, as long as the facilities for African Americans to get an education are separate and but equal to that of a traditionally white education, it's fine. It's constitutional. So
I'm sorry, I can't help but laugh because it's
this is like, I wanted, like, what if one of those justices, what if, like, a single one of them, what if they went to either school and were like, yeah, these are the same, practically interchangeable?
No. And that's the thing with when we look at, like, the Supreme Court in general, and we both watch a podcast that does a really good job of, like, breaking this down. The Supreme Court has this really good way of advertising themselves as being a political institution, which is, it's, like, not. It's by any means.
We enjoy being the worst as a country. You will soon find out.
Yeah. So, although I would contend we've gotten better, this is just one of the most fervent examples of just, however, like, bad.
Some slight karma reckoning, what have you, happens in the 1954 decision of Brown v. the Board of Education of Topeka, in which there's a unanimous decision that overturns Plessy v. Ferguson, that such schooling is in fact separate, correct, but in fact not equal. And this is a win, unless you're a racist. So,
which you're like automatically losing at life if you're racist.
Why are you a racist? Please. And the funny thing about racists, I'm saying so many things I never thought I would say. The funny thing about racists is that they feel very, very strongly about their opinions. And so obviously they just are not having this whole Brown v. Board business. And so they actually resist Brown v. Board. And then a year later, in 1955, there's a second decision. Brown is revisited and the ruling still stands. So there is a little catch here this time with the second ruling in Brown 2, because we had to make sure the racists were upset twice. The court says, and I quote, it orders, well, this is not an actual quote, it says it orders desegregation, this is the quote, with deliberate speed. So it's no longer a matter, which the funny thing is, like, if you want to piss a racist off, imagine telling them, like, not only do you have to do it, you have to do it now. You know? One community that decides to engage with this new jurisprudence is, I almost called it legislation, forgive me, is the town of Little Rock, Arkansas. Woo! So, no. just racist enough, but also just ballsy enough to go for this. And the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP, and its president, hold up, her name is Daisy, I believe. I can't read my own handwriting. It's the worst. her name is Daisy Bates. So, the NAACP president pressures the school board in Little Rock to desegregate, and the school board reluctantly agrees in 1957. So this is 2 years after Brown 2, 3 years after Brown 1. So out of this decision by the Little Rock, Arkansas school board, there are immediately two basic human rights groups with very racist intentions. We have Capital Citizens Council, and we have the Mothers League of Central High School. Now, I like to think about this Mothers League as like a group of PTA moms who are just incredibly racist. Imagine having like that PTA mom who's like just blatantly does not want you to go to school with a kid who has a different skin color. Catherine, do you have thoughts?
Imagine. I have thoughts. But we'll reserve them for now, because I just want to see where this is going.
Okay, so we have these two really awful groups of people. I feel like I can confidently say that. I'm not going... And if I offend anyone, I don't care. Bro.
Yeah, no, absolutely not. Like, we're all for tolerance of, like, freaking different political opinion, unless you're a fucking racist, then I don't care. I'm sorry. Like, I will offend you. And I hope I offend you.
Wow.
That is my hope.
Yeah.
If I don't, I'm not doing it right. So
I feel
that's where
I feel I'm very at. Naive saying anything bad about anyone, but then I'll say something bad about racists and feel good doing it. So
perfect.
Cut to the NAACP petitions to find, like, they vet through kids who are going to be able to be resilient enough to face these harsh circumstances to do the dangerous task of getting an education.
Crazy.
So the Little Rock Nine are assembled, and they are as follows. Mamie Jean Brown, Elizabeth Eckford, Ernest Green, Thelma Mothershed, Melba Patillo, Gloria Ray, Terrence Roberts, Jefferson Thomas, and Carlotta Walls. So they're vetted by the Arkansas NAACP, Daisy Bates. And get ready to meet the villain of our story. If you thought we met our villain yet, it is in fact found in the governor. Okay, the governor, his name even sounds evil. His name is Orville Faubus.
Orville
Faubus.
Like, he didn't even have a chance with that.
Like,
name.
I want to meet, like, the electorate that said, let's, in, like, just this incredible racist. His name sounds like a Bond villain. Like, that is who is going to lead our state to glory. I'm aghast. I cannot
believe it. SMH.
For real.
SMH. So,
Orville Faubus. What he does wrong, he invokes the Arkansas National Guard to prepare for violent opposition and bloodshed. And to prevent the Little Rock Nine from going to school. So he literally has the National Guard outside of Central High School so that these nine kids, when they show up, cannot get their education that is now constitutionally provided.
Imagine.
Let us discuss. When we talk about, like, federal power and things, I feel like that is, this is one thing that just, I can't get my mind around. Like, I understand being loyal to the citizenry of your state, but at the same time, like, bro, your name sounds like you kill puppies on the weekend. For recreation and leisure. And here you are being like blatantly the worst. Come on. So, Governor Orville Faubus has this happen. And the day before the first day of school is supposed to happen with desegregated attendance, the Mothers League comes back. And what do? They hold a protest at sunrise outside the school. And nothing really happens from this protest except a federal justice comes forward. His name, he's our hero of this story. His name is Ronald Davies. See, he even says, when I tell you guys that history, like, is full of sometimes blatant, just, like, poetry, a lot of the time it comes in, like, names. Like, George Washington, that man sounds like a leader. Yeah. Like, Taft?
Yeah. Arsinoe, like, she was the enlightened one. Yeah. Like, what?
Woman with uplifted mind. Yeah.
Yeah, that's why it's okay. Enlightened.
Or Taft definitely sounds like a president who would get stuck in a bathtub. Can we talk about that? Unironically. sorry, back to the Little Rock Nine. So, the first day of school happens. This is where shit hits the fan. This is where I start to get so very fervent and upset.
Weren't already.
It is
so
September 4th, 1957. And the president of the Arkansas NAACP is trying to get together a carpool so that the kids can go to school together, strengthen numbers type of deal. She's able to reach eight of the Little Rock Nine. But Elizabeth Eckert has no home telephone that she can be reached at. So she was unable to be informed of the plans to carpool. So Elizabeth Eckert shows up alone, where she is met with angry racist rioters. And one of the most iconic photos of the civil rights movement is produced. I'm going to do my best to describe it, but I'm also going to be putting it on our Twitter at history_timepod because you need to see it. And she is carrying books. She's very, very stoic. She's very, very calm. And she's surrounded by white people who are yelling at her.
That must have been the most terrifying thing ever. Mm-hmm. Like, the most terrifying thing ever. Like, this little girl trying to go to school. And, like, I just imagine, like, oh, my God.
The National Guard. The National Guard is there. She's got people yelling at her, probably degrading her as a human. Just because she's trying to get her constitutionally provided education. I cannot imagine her story.
Ew. If you do not feel gross about that, then, honey, yeah. I don't know what to tell you.
But then the other 8 kids roll up with Daisy Bates, and they're in this van. I'd like to imagine it's like the Mystery Machine and from Scooby-Doo, and like they roll up. They expect opposition, but I feel like my gut instinct is telling me that even what they got is worse than what they had expected. Which
I'm sure I don't think you can prepare for
that kind of pushback, especially senseless pushback. They really had no argument other than they just believed that these kids were unwanted.
That's so gross. Like,
they truly believed that they were less than human and that education is a human right, but not for them. So Len, our villain, comes back in. Governor Orville Faubus is attacked legally. I hope I got people excited when I just said attacks, and maybe karma got him, but no, he's attacked illegally, but it is by our boy, Federal Justice Ronald Davies. So Ronald Davies steps in and he says, Governor Orville Faubus, the National Guard is not to be used to discriminate against these children. So Davies says the National Guard has to go away on September 20th. So this is like almost 3 weeks later. The police then are called in to get the kids into the school building on September 23rd. So our boy gets rid of the National Guard, and the police of Little Rock escort the children to school. They don't make it through the entire day. Because as they are escorted to school that day by the police, the National Guard is left. Roughly 1,000 rioters are outside the school wanting the students removed. So the kids are escorted out before they can even finish one full day of their school. But this is where shit gets optimistic. On September 24th, so the next day, Eisenhower, the president of the United States of America at the time, calls in 1,200 of the U.S. Army's 101st Airborne Division and places them in charge of the police officers. So now we've got the police force and we've got 1,200 Army soldiers. And
damn,
because of this, the kids are able to go to their first full day of school on September 25th. However, violence continued throughout the rest of the year. All the kids were threatened, things happened. And the sad thing is, only one of the Little Rock Nine was a senior at the time. So only one of them graduated. However, this is kind of cool. At his graduation ceremony, Ernest Green, who was the oldest member and the only senior, graduates from the high school. And guess who's in attendance at his graduation?
Who?
Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
Goosebumps. Actually, just got goosebumps.
One of the Little Rock Nine receives his diploma. And cut to our villain. He has still made an appearance after being attacked legally. How rude of him. And he demands that the schools be closed the next year, pending a quote-unquote public vote.
For what? I don't know. Public vote for what? Like, what? You did this for why?
No
sir.
Sense. So there's no school the next year, which. Referendum,
sir. What are you doing? There's no school for a year.
He's a villain. Yeah. That is his strategy. He said, okay, you know what? If these kids are going to be in our schools and the president's going to be a little bitch about it, maybe, perhaps I can take away education for everyone. That would solve my problems.
Bro, this is such an uncomfortable topic because you just cannot believe how, like, bad this person is. Like,
Orville Faubus is the...
This wasn't socially unacceptable. Like, this was fine. Like, hello?
An uncomfortable amount of people don't know that this happened. They don't know that, like, there were 9 kids that faced their opposition.
Okay, I've heard the outline of this. Like, the outline that we got in, like, kindergarten, I remember learning a little bit about this. But, like, the way that you're telling it literally is making me feel just gross. Because I'm like, are you joking? People
believe this shit?
Oh, yeah. No.
So, we do have to talk about, what happened to Little Rock 9, okay? So, regardless of our villain, Faubus, literally just the worst, several of the Little Rock 9 go on to become, like, amazing people. So, Green, the guy who graduated and Martin Luther King was there, he served as the Assistant Secretary of the Federal Department of Labor under President Jimmy Carter. So imagine power that King. Has, okay?
King.
Minnie King. Jean Brown worked as Deputy Assistant Secretary for Workforce Diversity in the Department of the Interior under President Bill Clinton. So.
That's so recent.
That we'll is talk so about that recent. In a second. And then... Melba Patillo worked as a reporter for NBC. So, keep in mind, this is toward the beginning of the civil rights movement. I'm going to put it up there with, like, Emmett Till and its galvanization. Which, by the way, Emmett Till is another episode, but I will literally start crying.
Yeah, that one actually hits home a little
Mamie
bit.
Maybe Till Mobley deserved better. And we're going to talk about this because it's, these 9 kids galvanized the civil rights movement of the 60s. I mean, anything like Selma, we have to can talk about the Little Rock 9 when considering these things. And a lot of people don't even know that it exists. So for this impact in 1999, President Clinton awarded each member of the Little Rock 9 the Congressional Gold Medal for their efforts and their bravery in a time of strict scrutiny and adversity. So, applause for them. We have to give them one more honor, too. This one kind of hits home for me, just because when I really think about it, I think of how powerful it is. The Little Rock 9 all received personal invitations from President Barack Obama to attend his inauguration in 2009. The Little Rock 9 were personally invited to go to the inauguration of the first African-American president in American history.
I
know racism is not solved. Racism is the worst. And as much as I hate to admit it, the people that formed the Mothers League, they still exist today. They've just changed. Racist attitudes are still very prevalent in this country. But when I think about how hard the lives were for the people who fought in the civil rights movement and the adversity that these people went through, I just have to think about how far we must have come just because of their efforts. Like, we talk about individualized contribution to things, but these kids really did that.
Imagine how, like, utterly terrifying. Like, I've already said this, but, like, dude, as a little brown girl sitting here, like, going into a room with, like, angry white people yelling at you is literally my worst nightmare. Like, I've had those nightmares before. Oh my god, that literally sounds like my personalized room in hell. Like, that's horrible.
So, and on that note, we're now going to talk about more discrimination. So if you're just having too good of a day, we really hope we can put some things into perspective for you.
Oh my god, I hate it here.
Two just tiny little children a limited grip on the world. Yeah. On that note, Catherine's going to take it away. So if you have to take a little break, get some snacks. Maybe you need to take a break. You need to let some things sink in before you come back and hear more depressing shit.
I might have We're going to take a break, Blake. Like, I'm not going to lie to you.
We'll see you on the flip. Catch you on the flippity flip.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I've taken some time to gather myself, and now I'm very excited to bring you guys a story that does talk a little bit about racism, nativism, but also calls in question a lot of what we label today as like Fed power and like what the government can do, especially in times of crisis. And that is very relevant today, especially in a time of COVID, where like people are starting to question, you know, what can people do? Or what can governments do specifically? So, today I'm going to be talking about World War II, Japanese internment camps, the Supreme Court ruling that upheld Japanese internment camps, and I'm going to wrap it all up in a nice, cute little present and talk about the legal/authoritarian arguments being brought up then and today. So, World War II. I feel like World War II is one of those really unique moments in history that has really just captivated generations just through and through. I don't think it's like any other pocket of history, which like, I feel like other pockets of history are very niche. They're very like nerd, like based. And like, you have to be kind of a specific person to vibe, you know?
Oh, well, World War II changed everything. I mean, World War One did too. But it's funny how even World War One all the time gets overshadowed.
Yeah, it just pales in comparison and like magnitude of like how much people are just like enamored with this war. Like, people are just fascinated. And I think one of the lesser talked about aspects happens to be the main topic of the pod. But before we jump into that, let's get some history under our belt. So let's talk about what started World War II. Blake, do you wanna have some A push review right now?
There's nothing I would love more than to talk about the bombing of
Pearl Harbor. Okay, we'll get to that. But what happened before that?
So much to the point where I'm like, I don't know what you're trying to get out of me.
I was
right
just
now.
Hoping for a cute little list, but I'll just list some stuff. Germany was like hella aggressive, and they were put in a corner after World War One. But then they were like, no, we don't give a actual heck. Like, we're just gonna go at it. Thank you, Hitler. Actually, not thank you, Hitler. You know what I mean. Anyhow, they get all militaristic again. They, you know, do take over a lot of places. Won't get into the specifics, but in response, the global response was kind of this, like, idea of appeasement, which was just, like, let them do what they're gonna do. They want to avoid war because everybody saw how bad World War One was, so they're like, do we want that again? They collectively said no. That was, like, a really bad idea, but whatever.
Neville Chamberlain and his appeasement policy. Neville Chamberlain was, I believe,
he was. He was prime minister.
And he was the worst.
Not
that he was the worst. He had a very difficult decision to make, but
It didn't fare well in the context of history.
It seems complacent. It seems complacent to me. Yeah. But I understand. I have to sympathize.
Right. And then you had, like, no centralization when it comes to, like, global responses to stuff like that, because no League of Nations. You had
no United Nations, too.
You had a lame duck Hoover who, like, couldn't pass anything congressionally because, like, you know, he didn't get reelected. That's really interesting.
Damn. Get it?
And then you had fear and like a global depression, whatever. So I think we'll talk about the catalyst now. So the Allies joined the war after Hitler took over Poland. And then the U.S. was like super hesitant. So we just passed a bunch of acts to bypass and nullify the acts we like firstly passed to be neutral, which literally the United States has like the most interesting track record when it comes to stuff like this. Like, we have this track record of, like, passing legislation to bypass legislation we already passed. Like, we can see that with, like, who was it? McKinley in Cuba. Like, the Platt and the Teller. Yeah, that.
Platt and Teller, yeah.
When, like, he's like, okay, I'll stay out of Latin America. And then he's like, ah, JK. So, yeah. Thank you for that. Anyways, fast forward. Mm-hmm. December 7th of 1941. We had this huge attack done by militaristic Japan, who were, like, very, very powerful at this point, and were all nice with Hitler. This attack is known none other than as Pearl Harbor. This is kind of the most direct cause of the USA finally joining the war. Now, clearly, this attack had huge implications, not just for war, but for Americans. And no, I don't just mean manufacturing. Thanks to these attacks, Americans, Japanese Americans, experienced a lot of racism and nativism from both people and their government. But like many things in history, there's more to that. So I think to really understand it, we need to rewind to the Gilded Age and talk about the racism and the nativism that existed towards Asian Americans, which serves as like a continuity over time. When talking about the Gilded Age, we have to recognize the huge amounts of immigration that the United States was experiencing. Now, historically, Asian immigrants were discriminated against the most, especially when it comes to things like work. We had huge things like in California, Asian Americans had to pay a $20 tax in order to like find gold in California. And that was literally only for Asian Americans. We had bigger national things like the Chinese Exclusion Act, which was like a huge thing. Mm-hmm. It stopped the naturalization of Chinese immigrants and suspended travel, which 14th Amendment violation, who? Two, racist, okay. Three, wow, cannot believe. Anyhow, clearly, anti-Asian American sentiment was a continuity, and this time period is absolutely no different here. And this kind of was aggravated by the fact that Japan bombed us. So this leads into one of the most ew things that I think the United States has ever done. Domestically, I mean, yeah. I'm sure there's other stuff, clearly, but, like, this is also, like, very, like, it makes you feel uneasy, and it should. In 1942, FDR made Executive Order N-9006, which basically was the War Relocation Authority. It provided for the building of 10 permanent encampments that formed, and they basically took 120,000 Japanese American citizens and put them in these camps. Supposedly, the rationale for this was that these people were more predisposed to be spies for the Japan war effort. We'll get into that later.
Yeah.
But for now, let's just go through like what this process was. So, since the eastern coast of the United States was very heavily populated by Japanese Americans, most people were taken from, like, Los Angeles. And this is very interesting because, like, I was talking about earlier with, like, Gilded Age, a lot of Asian Americans went to Los Angeles. So, again, we can see that continuity of, like, this demographic being there.
Angel Island, yeah.
So, yeah, we kind of see that. And 2/3 of these people were American citizens and were only descendants from Japanese immigrants, which is absolutely insane. And they were, like, made,
It's, to me, it's it's interesting that there's the argument that, like, they even have citizenship mm-hmm. status. Like, they have gained citizenship. Like, the Constitution pertains to them, everything. They should have the rights endowed by their creator, but, like, this still happens. And like, today, when an argument like that comes up, it's a lot of time, like, it's the argument that they're mm-hmm. not citizens, the people in question. But even this is an example of time where they had citizenship and they still were denied some constitutional rights.
So, yeah, crazy. These people were basically told to pack up their lives in sometimes like less than a week to sometimes less than 24 hours. Like, while doing research, I heard a report that literally said that people that live very close to ports were actually told to pack up their lives in less than 24 hours because since they had, like, more idea of what was going on in regards to, like, ports and, like, the war effort and stuff, that could have been used as some type of, like, intelligence. But, yeah, still insane. So these people were basically relocated into isolated deserts, into small one-room apartments with little privacy. They were given standard army cots and blankets, and these people basically were told to just, like, adapt and to pick up their whole entire livelihoods wow. and just, like, go to this place. Like, can you imagine? Like,
I can't
to imagine. Leave your house, your business, your friends, you know, anything you've ever known, to go to the small, isolated desert, small room apartment thing.
Like, I have this feeling of dread thinking about going to college far away, and that's my
choice. And this was, like,
forced. I cannot imagine if this was coercive. Yeah, this is,
and, like, I saw this one documentary, I'm not gonna say from who, because, like, you know, I don't want to get into it, but it kind of made it seem like this glamorized thing where, like, these people were, like, I don't know. It was weird. It was really weird. And I was like, no, by any means, this was coercive. This was done by the U.S. Army. Like, no. Like, this was, no, absolutely not. Absolutely not.
They make it, like, they could have made it sound like it was symptomatic of the war effort. But, like, and they probably definitely did. But, like, they didn't have exactly. I don't think. And that's, maybe I'm naive in that, but I'm saying, unless there are proven, like, results, like, yes, this is something that was prevented by such restrictions.
Even then, there's been no intelligence to, like, do that, and even then, it's still racist and bad. But we'll get into, like, that, because I think mm-hmm. I know where you're heading down to. So let's talk about mm-hmm. how long this lasted, or, like, a little bit how this ended. I don't know. Okay, so basically, more racism persisted even after they were brought into these internment camps, and one statistic literally said that 35% of Americans thought that they should be allowed home after the war. So that means that the rest of Americans thought that these people should be left in the internment camps. These American citizens should be left in these concentration camps. Meanwhile, we were, you know, sensationalizing the Holocaust, which it should be publicized as much as possible. We should be calling the Holocaust mm-hmm. bad, clearly, by no means implying that we shouldn't. But do we see, like, the moral hypocrisy in which we're, like, operating under is kind of what I'm trying to get at. So this, like, sentiment was so persistent that these camps were open for over 3 years, and these people were not allowed to return to their homes until 1944. Now, after they returned to their homes were often robbed or just completely vandalized, and with no choice, many of these people fell destitute or even homeless. And the federal government really just said, "You can't see me," and just, like, disappeared. Because they gave absolutely no federal help.
Hold a John Cena.
Yeah, they really did. They gave no federal help. They gave no reparation. Crazy. So now let's get into, like, the legal case. So the legal case that pertains to this situation is Korematsu versus United States. So Fred Korematsu was a Japanese-American. He was born in America. He was just a descendant of Japanese Americans. Yes, that's what that was. So he defies the order that the U.S. Army implies to, you know, like, evacuate. And he stays in his home. And after the Army tried to evacuate him, and he says what everybody should have literally been shouting, "This is unconstitutional." And
go, yeah. Fred. Good for Fred. I even like his name. I can just be like Fred, which also that's like
an American name.
Can he I doesn't just have say? A very discriminatory. He doesn't have a very like highly discriminatory name itself.
No, because this man was American. I believe he was born in America. Like,
yeah. Frederick is similar.
That was his full name. That not... was his full name.
His full name was Fred.
Frederick.
Frederick? Yeah. Okay, yeah, that's not of Japanese descent. If anything, that was stigmatized by an American public when he was named.
Yeah. So, anyhow. And on a 6-3 majority decision, Hugo Black gives the decision that this is somehow, like, fine, and this is constitutional.
Oh!
Now, I want to talk about the legal, like, aspects of this. So, if you're familiar with, like, other judicial cases, you might be familiar with the basis of review for judicial cases, of which there are three. There's, like, a basis of, like, level of review, which is, like, the rational basis of review. Then you have, like, intermediate scrutiny, which is more, like, more of a step up than the rational basis. Mm-hmm. And it comes in with stuff like gender classification and, like, First Amendment stuff. And then you have the highest level, which is strict scrutiny, which
I think I said that earlier, and like I just meant like a high level of scrutiny, not judicial scrutiny.
Yeah, I caught that. Strict scrutiny pertains to constitutional matters when like the court actually decides if something is constitutional or not, which they do begrudgingly, may I say. It pertains to stuff like racial discrimination, mostly applying to, like, equal protection. Article 2 of the 14th Amendment. Ah, right? Article 2. Wow. Article 2. We're going to say Article 2. Sorry.
Article 2 is executive.
Okay. Moving on. Moving on. Okay, so this decision somehow passed a strict scrutiny of judicial review. Can we just think about that for like 2 seconds?
They took out their very large magnifying glass. This
somehow putting people of a certain origin in a camp past strict scrutiny. Just very bad. Okay. Moving on, let's talk about implications and what happened after this. So, Charles Fahey, which I forgot the role he really played. Like, he was... Okay, so before something goes to the Supreme Court, it has to pass through district courts, okay? And so, Charles Fahey was involved in the district court process, to my knowledge. And he basically said that the intelligence community itself... He, like, suppressed information that said the intelligence community itself had no data pointing to Japanese Americans being a threat to national security or even spies. So the whole notion that the Japanese Americans had this, like, intent or, like, there is some type of data or intelligence that even pointed to that is absolutely fabricated in itself. And this man, Charles Fahey, suppressed that himself. So, one, bad, and two, oh my gosh, how? Anyhow. Now this was done again in a district court. So the ruling in which that happened under was clearly like false. So that district court was a prerequisite to the Supreme Court. So in 83, the conviction was overturned. However, the actual decision has never been overturned. The actual decision has never been overturned. The conviction was because, you know, like something was suppressed, something was lied to. They were like, they made the ruling under like false pretenses, whatever. It was wrong either way. But, you know, the decision was not. Now, I believe Eric Holder was attorney general in 2014. He basically made it so, like, this decision couldn't hold any legal precedent because it's like uniquely bad. It's like uniquely really, really bad.
It is, in fact, chaotic evil.
It is indeed. So that is the story of the Japanese internment camps during World War II and the legal case that upheld them.
Okay, gang. Now comes the fun little time where Catherine and I give you our unsolicited thoughts and feelings, and you're going to like it.
Yeah. It's our favorite part of the pod.
So, really, Catherine, so, like, what we're trying to go for with this episode, we're trying to talk about, like, authoritarianism.
Yeah.
Federalism.
And, like, racism. All racism, of the isms.
Nativism. The isms. Yes. Imperialism. Consumerism. Maybe not that one. Mm-hmm. But maybe that one. I don't know. Who knows?
That one.
Well, no.
We could spin it.
We're going to say no to that one, though.
Yeah.
But yeah.
We already talked about consumerism last episode. So I think where both of our stories kind of find their, like, middle, I guess, is when we're talking about, like, what the government can and cannot do. I mean, the minority decision on Brown v. Board literally argued that, you know, if we desegregated schools, that white people would be mad at black people. And, like, that we should be, like, protecting black people as if, like, I don't know, just, it's weird. And then when we look at, like, my case, we talk about, like, Japanese internment camps and how, like, that was really bad. And, like, at the same time, we were also, like, you know, making this narrative that we were righteous and fighting for democracy, all while putting our own American citizens in internment camps because of racism. So, you know, America kind of has a history of being very shoddy when it comes to stuff like that. So I think it's really important to talk about, like, how we see that today. Racism manifests in our laws, and how we see the precedent of these authoritarian actions being brought up in a time of a global health crisis. So with that being kind of prefaced, do you have thoughts?
Blake? Yeah, I saw on Twitter, you know, there was a photo that circulated, and it was a nurse with a mask standing on a crosswalk blocking a car with a protester the protester was blocking, like, basically, like, the quarantine stay at home order, what have you. Which, that's where I'm drawing the line, and I don't know. That's where we're leaving it up to interpretation. This is the discussion. They have rights to voice their opinions, but at the same time, like, is it a clear and present danger when they're out amidst a global health crisis? And I think it's important to monitor, like, authoritarianism. That is one of the foundations of this country. It's constitutionally provised to where that's something we hold disdain for, but at the same time, there are extenuating circumstances that can change that.
Right. And I think it's very funny. We talked about this a little bit in a prior episode, like, how people forget, like, clear and present danger, or, like, necessary and proper, all these, like, provisions that the Constitution clearly gives us for extenuating circumstances. And I think people that are, like, out here sharing, like, Ben Franklin quotes saying that, like, those who give up a little bit of liberty or an essential liberty for a little bit of safety are, like, wrong. And I'm sitting here, I'm like, okay, you're not Ben Franklin in the Revolutionary War, Karen.
The other thing is, if, like, we think about Ben Franklin, that was a man who was like, let me take this kite, let me take this metal key, and let me go outside in a fucking thunderstorm. That's why I'm just like, you have to take it with a grain of salt. That man was out of his goddamn mind sometimes.
Yeah, and I don't know. Personally, of course we need to respect others' opinions. Of course you have the right to protest. Mm-hmm. But also, you need to measure yourself. Mm-hmm. You need to actually think through things and not let, like, stupid ideas and stupid, like, media influence your decisions when, like, health professionals are saying something else completely.
Yeah.
And
when you're the mother, sorry, when you're the Mothers League of Little Rock, you're just kind of like, you have these rights, but read the room, hon. Read the room.
Yeah, read the actual room. Like, I don't know. I just have beef. Because although, like, it's bad. I'm sorry. There, I don't know. It's weird, and I don't like it at all. Because, like, I read this article that said, like, specifically to Colorado protests, that these protesters were blocking the street to the point where, like, ambulances couldn't get through into hospitals. And they were blocking the ER entrances. Like, how absolutely horrible that is that? Like, that's not a protest. That's, like, a first-degree manslaughter charge, if you ask me. If anybody died, I truly hope, like, some type of legal thing is, like, set. Because that shit is unacceptable by any means.
I want to start a new thing on this pod where anytime someone does something sketchy as hell, I want to be like, just yell the word litigation.
Honestly,
like, you know, sometimes people are like, sue their ass. I just want to like have a new thing when something pisses either of us off and it kind of is either unconstitutional or morally wrong, legally wrong.
The person we should sue of the day.
The person we should sue of the day. That sounds like a great thing.
So today litigation. We're suing. Today we're going to be suing everyone protesting. Every single person.
Today we're going to be suing everyone who's restricting access to healthcare because of their own selfish intents.
Right. And, like, a lot of these people were saying that, like, they want to go back to work and, like, we need to worry about the economy. And, like, trust me, economy arguments are so important. But economists are saying that we can't actually go back to a working, functioning economy until we fix this. And do you know how we fix this?
We wait it out.
Yeah, we need to make sure our healthcare systems are doing well and not, like, literally drowning in people dying as they are right now. We need to make sure we have universal testing, which the federal response has just been abysmal to COVID-19. And I just don't mean executive either. I mean the both judicial response with, like, Wisconsin and, like, other states.
Oh.
Like, yeah, has just been abysmal. And so, I mean, Congress has done an awesome job, but there's a lot of provisions that have just been, like, kind of bad, like, for small businesses. I've read a lot of stuff saying that, like, small businesses aren't actually getting the relief they are, and, like, bigger corporations are getting, like, a lot of the federal response money.
Yeah, I remember
that was supposed to go to small businesses.
Right at the beginning, people were really upset about, like, airline companies.
Right.
I saw one reply on Twitter that was like, maybe the airline companies wouldn't need government help if they just worked a little bit harder.
I'm dead.
I was like, that one. Litigation!
Yeah. Litigation! Yeah, I don't know. I think it's just bad. Like, come on. Yeah. And you know another thing that kind of blew my mind about those protests is the fact that, like, a lot of these people weren't really there, like, how do I phrase that? They were there for, like, clearly to, like, appeal the stay-at-home order, but they were more so treating it as, like, a political rally. Like, clearly there was one side represented more than, like, any other political ideology. And I read a bunch of stuff, and I was listening to a podcast, Crooked Media, by the way, if you're not familiar with, like, Pod Save America and Pod Save the World, they're amazing and hilarious, and you should listen to them. We're saying that a bunch of these protests in, like, Michigan were being set up by, like, alt-right groups and propagated by, like, alt-right groups.
And then the president of the United States tweets, hashtag liberate Michigan in all caps.
Yeah, what is that, by the way? Like, what? And, oh my god, I saw, like, actual replies that basically hypothesized that since he tweeted, like, protect your Second Amendment, he was, like, implying that they should, like, bring guns to these rallies. And
gun
was,
sales,
like,
have gone up since COVID-19, which I understand that often happens in times of crisis. Yeah. People are scared, things like that.
Of course. But also, these weren't the people that were mad about the Patriot Act. These aren't the people that are mad about Japanese internment camps. These aren't people that, when, like, things happen that are authoritarian, usually come out. So I just think it's very funny that, like, when it's a war, it's fine. But when it's people dying in your country, like elderly, immunocompromised, not elderly, not immunocompromised, just like regular fucking people. We're just like, but the economy.
Yeah.
I'm like,
Another thing I saw, I keep referencing Twitter, but I promise if I'm like referencing Twitter, it's a credible source. But it was like, I think it was the Wall Street Journal saying something about like, we need to consider the economic impacts if like hundreds of thousands of people are sick at a time. Right. Like, whatever.
That is a whole nother economic impact.
Yeah.
Like, and, I think we're gonna... It's a bad time, and I don't think anybody really knows what's going on. Mm-hmm. And anybody that tells you that they know what's going on is lying.
They are lying.
Don't believe them.
I retweeted something that said, I'm sick of living through a major historical episode.
Yeah, like, can we just fast forward? Mm-hmm. I do not mean to seem selfish. I do understand people are dying, but if I don't get a summer of 2020, I might just cry. Like, summer is a time my personality comes back. During the school year, I feel like
school is your personality.
Yeah, but I have a personality outside of school, and I just need to wait until like July, because then I'm like peak.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
Wow. We talked about a lot.
School is your personality.
We talked about a lot of heavy things today. So, the point of this podcast, though, too, we're talking about history and applying it to today. And the biggest thing, if we haven't said it yet, is that, like, what's happening outside in the world is history. Whereas there's arguments you can make that, like, connections you can draw. This, in itself, is something I think is truly unique.
Of course. Like, we've never seen anything like it in this scale.
I saw on Twitter, maybe you tweeted this. Is it the word of the year is going to be unprecedented?
Unprecedented? Yeah. Yeah, I did.
Wow. It was a quality tweet.
Thank you. I deleted it because I spelled psychic wrong. I said not to be psychic or anything, and then I spelled psych.
Oh.
I was like, wow. You're so smart.
That's great. I'm really proud of you, Catherine.
That's my AP Lang working.
Oh my goodness. This we kind of held off on our corona episode because we were just like, people don't need to hear about that. But at the same time, we hit a point this week where we're just like, you know, we should probably address it.
Yeah, I think we've just kind of been talking in circles. Mm-hmm. And also, we pre-film these episodes a week in advance. So, who knows
a week from now,
these protests.
Mm-hmm. A week from now,
yeah, who knows?
Shit could still be hitting the fan even more so.
Yeah. Yeah, and what I anticipate the most is since these protests have already been, like, propagated and blown up by media sources, more people are gonna do it, and they're gonna continue violating social distancing and quarantines and like protesting stay-at-home orders, and it's not gonna be good.
No,
it's not gonna be good.
So here's our solution for if you're feeling stressed out or anything like that: listen to a podcast, read a book, sit outside.
Oh my gosh, yes, read a book. I've been reading. I've refound my passion for reading. I have a book recommendation, too.
Spit it out.
I've been reading Pete Buttigieg's... Yeah, that's right. His biography.
Wow.
Called Coming Home or something like that. It's literally sitting on my
bed.
Is
it long? Shortest way home?
Maybe, actually.
Fastest way home? Something like that.
What's Shortest Way Home? By Pete Buttigieg.
Wow, we love autobiography.
So far... Yeah, I'm on page 27, and it's actually quite, like, informational. Like, I don't know how I feel about biographies, because I don't read many of them, but, like...
Informative.
It talks about, like, industrial America, and how cities that have been kind of disheveled by automation have kind of recovered. He grew up in South Bend, Indiana, which used to be, like, one of the peak cities in the 20s, along with, like, Detroit and, you know, all the places we know about. And I think it's really interesting, like, hearing kind of, like, that perspective because, I mean, when we talk about like history specifically with like automation and like how we see like jobs leaving, factories leaving the United States, I think we talk about it in a very broad sense and we don't really examine the implications it has on like local communities and people. And I think thus far this book has done a really good job of humanizing that, because it's like, it's different, you know, hearing like the, I don't know, the community part of it.
So yeah, take Catherine's advice, read a book, stay sane. Mm-hmm. Anything else you'd like to add, Catherine?
Be good to yourself, bro.
Be good to yourself. Yeah, like, now's not the time. Now's not the time to be alone with your thoughts.
It's not. Like, if you need to take a 3-day break from homework and schoolwork, do it. That's what I've been doing. Yeah. And
on that note, we're gonna thank you for listening. We're gonna wish you to have a great day. And once again, thank you for tuning into His Story Time.